I don't know that I've met everybody here. I've certainly met both of you before, but thank you so much. I'm going to stand around here and just kind of lean casually. My name is Roy, and I have a real problem with history research. I find my Zen place is scrolling through names in just page after, just looking for that. It's kind of like a hunt. I always say it's kind of like that primal instinct to find and gather something that's valuable out of the quagmire of knowledge that would otherwise be thrown away. The Dawn of Crime is a series that also surprised me, and I've got to really put this out there. I never wrote any books with the intention of anybody necessarily reading them. This is more, the finished product is really honestly just a means to an end. This is just so I can begin that cycle again of addictive research. I think for me the big one was the Squizzy Taylor biography. I wanted to publish a story about something incredible. When I was about 11 years old, my dad said to me, I was watching a TV show and Al Capone was flashed across the screen. And my dad said to me, we were in Hong Kong at the time, that's where we lived, and he said, you know, we had a guy similar to Al Capone in Australia called Squizzy Taylor. I don't know if you can remember the first time you heard that name, Squizzy Taylor, right? But doesn't it have that ring? It has that kind of, it's not a people name. It's not a pet name, it's not a people name, but it's got something magical about it. But it's also got that dark, sinister name. But even before I knew what he'd done or who he was, it had that sinister ring to it. So I started researching Squizzy Taylor. I found there's one book, just one book had been written. Now, look, it's a book written in the 70s by a very good historian, but he was so limited to what he had access to, and predominantly it was just microfiche. For those of you who are under 38, Google microfiche. Anybody remember microfiche? It was horrible, wasn't it? You'd take a Quell to stop getting seasick as the frame squiz, you know. And he was doing his best to try and find out who Squizzy Taylor was on microfiche at a library, right? With the benefit of a phone in your hand, right, I can digest so much more in an hour than he probably did in the whole book. So in researching Squizzy Taylor, I read the better part of 30,000 newspaper articles, right? And it was a pleasure. I got to say, I'm not saying, oh, poor me. I loved it. Like, again, I only published that so I can read another 30,000 newspaper articles. But as I was researching that book, I kept finding these incredible stories. Now, they're not Squizzy Taylor stories necessarily. They're linked to his story, but they don't have a place in his biography. Does that make sense? And then at the end of it, I'd have a semi-complete, you know, short biography. And I didn't know what to do with it. So I said to a very good friend of mine, Tammy, who's, I'm barely literate at times. I kind of just punch it in. I can't get an address right. I'm present, right? And I said to my friend Tammy, if I send you the raw data, do you think you could put it together? So she did. And as a bit of a, you know, something fun, we put together the first Dawn of Crime book. It's 12 biographies, short biographies. But they all somehow link to Squizzy Taylor. One of them is the lady on the cover is the lady who was making bootleg sly grog for Squizzy Taylor's enemy. Right? So that's kind of your links. And it kind of snowballed, and lo and behold, 7,000 people bought it. And we were gobsmacked, absolutely gobsmacked. So then I said, well, I've got enough for another one. So off we went with another one. Number two came out. Didn't sell quite as well at first, but it kept bubbling away and people would buy it. I thought, geez, these people are as addicted as I am. They've got the same problem. There's got to be a 10-step program for all of us. But we, you know, kept putting these books out. But by the third book, I kind of thought, this is a bit fun. So we made a book that had a theme. And the theme was, of course, The Queerest of Crimes. Now, The Queerest of Crimes was a departure from necessarily Squizzy Taylor stories. And the stories and the biographies of The Queerest of Crimes all contained a criminal act where gender or gender atypical behavior was a key focus of the crime. There used to be these incredible set of rules and laws that we're so lucky we don't have now. But one of them was offensive behavior. If you did something that could be deemed as offensive behavior, man, you could go away for 2 years. And that included wearing gender atypical clothing. You're born with male genitalia and you wear what was considered female typical clothing. Someone takes offense, you're off to the cells. And I mean, we think that surely not, that was real. So I made this set of stories and we put it together in a book. Again, the people who collect the Dawn of Crime books gathered those stories and they enjoyed them as well. We skip forward now to the fifth book, and this is, I wouldn't have imagined this was going to happen, but the fifth book is now published. We had two false start events. This could have been out a year ago, but God bless you, COVID. This book is called The Color of Crime, but I have to be honest and say that I actually had, you know, you have those half ideas? You know, like I'm going to make a jetpack one day. I don't know, just stuff like that, just a hoverboard. This is my hoverboard. I wanted to make this a long time ago, but I didn't really have necessarily a formula to make it in. The Dawn of Crime gave me that. And also, I found it really emotionally challenging in some ways. I make this joke to make others comfortable, but it's not necessarily something that I make easily. But my family are Aboriginal on mum's side, which makes me Aboriginal, as you can clearly see. My brothers are darker shades. I claim to be the white sheep of the family. I feel very connected to my Aboriginal family and ancestry, and I love and cherish the bits of information I've been able to glean about our pre-colonisation history. When this jail we're lucky to be in tonight was operational, Queen Victoria was almost exclusively the reigning monarch who was the queen of the day. Well, you can, now, I say her name, you picture her, don't you? A little rotund woman, and there she is on her throne, and she's, you know, giving her, presiding over nations and nations. Same time period, the people that my mum comes from, the Dja Dja Wurrung, which is that area, a land block just above Ballarat, up to a bit above Avoca, that were pushed off the land because of Gold Rush, when they were invaded, they also had a queen, Queen Gelibung. And she was about this big, I would imagine. She was little, she was elderly, she was rotund. Same age, same time period as Queen Victoria at the same time. Her story is in here because there's a lot of speculation that she was treated in a way not dissimilar to Boadicea. Do you say Boadicea? Is that how we say it now? Boadicea, Boadicea, the Nicene queen who was raped by the Romans. There's a very good set of evidence to say that she also was mistreated in the same way, and it began a play, a theatrical play. I found that very challenging to write. I find sometimes the empathy in these people isn't lost on me. The story of Arthur Skerritt is a story that starts when he's 18, and I stumbled upon him because he is directly connected to Squizzy Taylor, or I should say Squizzy Taylor's enemy. 1919, pistols started barking all the way around Fitzroy as Squizzy Taylor would drive past the boxer Ted Whiting's house and bang, 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 and then the next night off we would go back and forth, back and forth. And in the heat of that moment, there was a guy called Arthur Skerritt who was in and present around that time, and he was picked up by the cops, and he's walking along and he was holding his shoes in one hand, and he's very carefully tiptoeing, and he had his other hand stiffly like this. It'd be an odd sight, wouldn't it? Now, Australia wasn't a place where people of coloured skin were going to be openly out and about. This is well after midnight, and he's creeping around looking up under windows. A copper pulled him over and probably quite earnestly said, "What are you doing?" "Oh, nothing, nothing, nothing." So he patted him down, and out of his sleeve came a truncheon. And it's on display here. It's a piece of leather about so long, and it's been kind of made into a tube and faithfully stitched to the end. In the end of it, there's, I imagine, look, I'd love to know what's in it. I'm going to guess it's a piece of roofing lead. So it's a bit flexible, but if you belt someone with that, it's going to really, really whack them good. And he said to the cop, "I need to keep this because I'm terrified that Ted Whiting will give me a flogging." They're not his exact words, but they're pretty close. Pretty close to his exact words. Now, Ted Whiting was a world welterweight boxing champion in his own right. We're talking Jeff Fenwick, Costa Zoo level of fame. And he'd retired from an international boxing career, and he thought to himself, with all this fame and all this money, I'm going to go back to Fitzroy and I'm going to stand over every person with a shop and run brothels and slide rug shops. I mean, I'm not making this up. And that was how he made his career. But he also made a career out of standing over individuals, and Arthur Skerritt was one of them. And I thought to myself, what a fascinating side story to the Squizzy Taylor story. I started reading about this poor guy. And I have to, I said it a second ago, the empathy I have for these are human beings, these are people like you and me. These are people who had hopes and dreams and aspirations, and he ended up in that room on the night he died, right? And Arthur Skerritt begins his story in the public eye at 18, which pretty quickly tells me he was in the law or interacting with the law before then, but we don't have those records because they expunged them. Does that make sense? We find him at 18 and he's done something very gratuitously illegal to a couple of women, and he's taken to Pentridge. Now, we think, oh, well, probably getting what he deserves. All the newspapers at the time almost treated it like a football player who did something amazing. Kicked 10 goals, what a great guy, and the smile on his face. And they describe it in the same kind of way. That Arthur Skerritt was walked into the flogging cells with a great big smile on his face, but he didn't have one on the way out. Now, the horror that that young man had in that experience is not lost on me. But we're talking about a man who I don't believe had full cognizance of his own surrounds. His life involved a horrific murder, which he almost unquestionably committed. And there were several instances, including the moment where he was in court for carrying the truncheon to protect himself against Ted Whiting, where they recalled the court because he wasn't cognizant of what was being said. We're talking about a guy who really wasn't competing with all of the same equipment as another crook with a good lawyer. This book is full of cases that you read and you think to yourself, if he was white in this country at that time, or if it was today. And with that backdrop that we can compare it to, context is everything, isn't it? I've got 6 amazing kids. And as I came in here tonight with one of them, he made me so proud. He said to me, he stopped me as we were coming in, he looked at the outside of the building, he said, when this was active, what would have been here on the outside? And we looked around and I said, probably most of these houses, that part of, and the cobblestones in the gutter would have been where the asphalt is now. So then let's kind of unpack that a bit. The average person who was in this cell, this that we're in, walking out here to see you guys sitting here, me with those chairs, with this lectern, with the gadgets in your hands and the microphone, this would be like science fiction to him, right? We see those images of when somebody gets abducted and put on a spaceship and it's all stainless steel, everybody's wearing white. That's how foreign it would have been to be out there now for these guys. But if you went back in time, the same kind of thing. The very sound and smell go through your senses. You'd be walking down the street with cobblestones and anything moving on those, that makes a hell of a noise on cobbles. The wheels aren't rubber, they're hard and they clack, clack, clack as they move along. One of those clack, clack, clacks that moves along is the guy who goes down behind your house to pick up the poo that you've done in a bucket to take away for you. And the smell that that creates and his horse that drops it there and the gutter where the inadequate sewage leaves trails of rotting, festering food and liquid everywhere. The smoke that's in everybody's chimney that's now permeated all your clothes, along with the body sweat that you have on your body, because as you look at the seams of your clothes, you see the machine stitching. They weren't machines, they were hand stitched. So you wouldn't wash them often because they'd fall apart. So you wear them as long as you possibly could, and the poorer you were, the longer you'd wear them, and the fewer of them you'd have, and you would stink. So they would make up an expression. The expression for that was, "Ah, don't eat, he smells like work," and they made that a good thing. So every part of your experience in that time and place is nothing like it is here. What I've tried to do with all the Dawn of Crime books, and as you can probably see, I spend a lot more time than I should thinking about this kind of stuff. I've tried to unpack the redactive analysis of what that person was dealing with as that crime took place. Not just, here's a guy, he killed someone, it's like if you did it, but really understand what it was like to have that experience at that time in that place for that individual. I talk a little bit about, and I'll make this the last story I tell you, the very difficult piece that I wrote was called The Blood Hole Massacre. The Blood Hole Massacre is, again, of my people, from the Dja Dja Wurrung, and very well known and documented. The Dja Dja Wurrung people would go from their own area, which is above Clunes in Victoria, up through Avoca to the Grampians, and they would trade thatched grass goods that they made with the Grampians people. And so the Dja Dja Wurrung and the people of the Crow would head up to the people of the Eagle, and they would trade for stone axe heads and other goods. They'd also have ceremonies that swap brides to grooms, and this is how they interacted on an annual basis. On the way back, they were about two-thirds of the way back. The man who owned a station, a cattle station called McDougall, he's a red-headed man that, from what I understand, it was a reasonably objectionable guy that nobody liked. He was a pretty ugly character. Came home from work on his horse with his drovers, and the cook had been killed. He was killed in such a way that it wasn't suicide, it was murder. And he said, "I know who's done it. It's the Aboriginals." And I'll probably say it nicely. They got on their horses with their guns and they rode. When they found the mob coming back from the Grampians, they were trailing alongside a river because you get food alongside a river, and they opened fire. The women and children, and we understand to be one of my ancestors as a baby, on her mother's hip, ran to Avoca, leaving the men. And there's an estimate between about 100 and 150, sometimes some people say 300, but realistically probably about 150 people were shot and killed that day as they cowered in the water to try and save their lives. He faced no consequences, very open about it. One of the fascinating ends to that story, and this is that context, I wanted to know what happened to him, and I wanted to know what happened to the next generation. His own wife was with her infant son in that area, and he was, I think, three at the time, and he went down to the same water's edge, and she followed him, and he tripped. Going into the water, her heavy Victorian flowing dress caught the water and dragged both of them under, and they both died in that same place that he killed all those people. I'm not very superstitious, but that's a fascinating and eerie reminder of what goes around, man, comes around. I want to thank you guys for coming tonight. For those of you watching and playing along at home, Christmas is coming up, and if you have a loved one and they don't buy you all of the Dawn of Crime books, they don't love you very much. It is a thrill to be here. And again, thank you so much for coming out on this not COVID night, either side of probably a COVID outbreak. And thank you for coming.